The following preview is of a graphic audio production rated for mature audiences due to scenes of intense violence and sexual situations.
Available now in graphic audio. The war between Dante Valentine and the devil has been building.
Hey, Blondie, you two-faced lying sack of demon shit. You've got business with me first.
Indeed, I do.
Now, all will be settled in one epic final confrontation.
Here I stand, Lucifer, and not all the hosts of hell shall move me.
Not all the hosts of hell are necessary, Necromans.
Just one.
Dante Valentine number 5, to hell and back. The thrilling conclusion to the Dante Valentine series.
There is more than one way to break a human.
And now, our feature presentation.
Graphic audio. A movie in your mind. Graphic audio presents William W. Johnstone, Smoke Jensen, The Mountain Man number 31. Ambush of the Mountain Man, narrated by Mort Shelby, with performances by James Lewis, Drew Kopis, Tim Getman, Elizabeth Jernigan, Richard Rowan, MJ Casey, Terrence Aselford, Kimberly Gilbert, James Konacek, Stephen Carpenter, Dylan Lynch, Michael Glenn, Eric Messner, and Johann Detweiler.
Smoke Jensen and his friends Cal, Pearly, and Lewis Longmont turned their horses' heads south and rode out of the town of Noyes, Minnesota. They rode slumped in their saddles, dog-tired after the months they'd spent in Canada working for William Cornelius Van Horn. Cal, still excited about the adventures they'd had and the unforgettable scenery of the northern Rocky Mountains, jabbered on and on about how he wished he'd been born in the days of the mountain men. Lewis and Smoke just looked at each other and smiled, for they knew those days hadn't been nearly as romantic as they'd sounded in the stories Cal had heard around the campfire from Beartooth and Red Bingham and Bobcat Bill. Of course, they weren't about to tell the youngin' that and ruin his ideas about the good old days. They rode on for about 2 miles until they came to the railroad station that was their goal. They reined in their mounts in front of the station master's office.
That was very nice of Bill Van Horn to arrange for us to ride all the way back to Big Rock on the train instead of on horseback.
Whew, yeah. It'll sure save me some wear and tear on my backside. The way I feel now, if I never see another saddle as long as I live, it'll be all right with me.
Not only that, but Bill said we could ride in James Hill's own private car on our trip south.
Hill? Ain't he the man Bill said bought up all the railroads in this part of the country?
That's right, Cal. Hill owns just about every inch of railroad track between here and home.
Jiminy, and his own private car ought to be something to see.
I would imagine it would be rather lavish.
Well, I don't know what lavish means, but I hope it means stocked right well with food, because I am hungry enough to eat a bear.
After Smoke spoke to the station master and their horses and gear were stowed in the cattle car, the man showed him into James Hill's private car. As the station master stepped down out of the car, a man moved out of the shadows next to the station building and stood there staring at the train.
Howdy.
Hello. If you're here to buy a ticket on this train, you need to see the man in the ticket booth inside the building.
Thanks. I just might do that. By the way, was that man I just saw getting on the train named Smoke Jensen?
Yep.
You tell me how far Smoke Jensen and his friends are going?
Well, I believe they're ticketed all the way through to Big Rock, Colorado.
And I'll need a ticket to the same place?
Yes, sir.
And I need to know if I have time to send a wire before the train leaves.
Oh, no, sir, I don't believe you do.
Damn.
But I'd be happy to send one for you after the train leaves, if you wish.
Well, perfect. It's to Angus McDougal in Puebla, Colorado. Just say our friend is headed for home. Should be there in 10 days.
Will there be anything else, sir?
Nope. I think that ought about do it.
Smoke saw Lewis pouring himself a glass of brandy into a bell-shaped crystal goblet from Hill's private bar in the corner. Lewis swirled the amber liquid for a moment, and then he sniffed delicately of the aroma. His face relaxed and he smiled, as if he had died and gone to heaven. Cal had taken his boots off and was lying back on the overstuffed sofa, poking the cushion with his hands, feeling how soft they were. Pearly was over in the opposite corner, and he had his hands on the bell rope, about to pull it.
Pearly, what are you doing?
I'm just ringing this here bell to see if the man who answers it can get us some food before I faint from hunger.
Why don't you have a cup of coffee to fill your gut until the train leaves the station? Then we can see about getting some grub.
Coffee? Oh, and Pearly, there's a bowl of sugar and a pitcher of cream here on the bar to sweeten it up with.
Well, now, I guess now that you mention it, that coffee will do for a start.
Coffee does sound good.
2 hours later, the men had finished their meal and were sitting around a table in Hill's private car getting a poker lesson from Lewis. Luckily for Cal and Pearly, they were playing for pennies instead of dollars, because Lewis and Smoke were each winning just about every hand. Just as Lewis was leaning over to rake in another pot, the train suddenly slowed.
What the? Look there!
A group of men could be seen suddenly appearing from a copse of trees near the track, all riding bent down low over their saddle horns, guns in their hands, and bandana masks over their faces.
Well, I'll be hanged. It looks like the train is going to be robbed.
I'll be damned if any two-bit train robbers are going to take any of my money.
No one's going to take any money from any of us, Lewis.
I'll get our rifles from our gear in the next car.
Bring some extra ammunition, too. It looks like there's 15 or 20 riders out there we're going to have to contend with.
Smoke ducked down out of sight, motioning the others to do the same as the train slowed and the group of riders drew abreast of the car they were in. The window next to Smoke's head shattered, sending slivers of glass cascading down onto his back and causing a tiny solitary drop of blood to appear on his neck.
First blood to them.
Pearly came scuttling back into the car with his arms full of long guns. Smoke took the Henry repeating rifle from Pearly and watched as Lewis took the 10-gauge sawed-off express gun and an extra box of shells from him.
You're gonna have to get awfully close for that to do much damage.
I thought I'd wait until they came knocking on our door and then give them a rather loud greeting.
Good idea. I think I'll take Cal and Pearly and slip out the far side of the car when the train stops. When the bandits get off their horses to make their way through the cars, it'll give us a chance to scatter their mounts.
And then they'll be trapped out here in the middle of nowhere with nothing to ride off on. Good idea, Smoke.
When the train finally ground to a complete stop, Lewis turned a big easy chair around until it was facing the door. And then he took a seat, the express gun across his knees and his pistols on a small table next to the chair.
Good hunting, gentlemen.
You be careful, you hear?
It is not I that should be careful, my friend. It is those miscreants that are interrupting our trip who should be saying their prayers at this time.
Smoke and the boys slipped out of the car and moved slowly down the line of cars toward the front of the train.
Smoke, what's a miscreant?
It's someone without a shred of decency in their character, Cal.
Oh.
Smoke gave the robbers time to climb aboard the train before he put the Henry in his left hand, sauntered out from between two cars, and walked slowly toward the outlaws' horses, which were being tended by a large, fat man with a full beard and a ragged, sweat-stained hat set low on his head. Cal and Pearlie untied the horses from where they'd been hitched to the rail on the railroad car, and they shooed them away. Smoke and Pearlie headed back along the tracks toward the passenger cars and went inside. Smoke and Pearlie moved through three more cars before catching up to the robbers in the car just before Hill's private one that Lewis was in. Smoke motioned for Pearlie to kneel down in front of the door, and then he stood over him as he jerked the door open. A crowd of robbers were in the aisle collecting passengers' money and jewels. Six outlaws went down before the others could return fire. The bandits in the lead jerked open the door to Hill's car and rushed inside. Lewis was waiting for him. Four more men went down, shredded and almost cut in half by the horrendous power of the express gun. The seven men remaining alive dove off the train out of the connecting door to the cars and began running as fast as they could back up the tracks to where they thought their horses were tied. They slowed and looked around with puzzled expressions when they came to Johnny's dead body.
They're gone, you bastards!
The robbers turned and saw Smoke and Pearlie and Lewis standing there, side by side, their hands full of iron. Carl Jacoby sat staring out of the train window next to his seat, sweat beading on his forehead and running down his cheeks, as he thought about just how fast with a gun Smoke Jensen and his friends had proved to be. Jacoby was one of Johnny McDougal's best friends, or at least he had been until Jensen and his men had shot his friend down in the streets of Pueblo, Colorado, just last year. Jacoby hadn't been there, being sick with the grip at the time, but he'd been told Jensen had shot Johnny down in cold blood without even giving him a chance to clear leather. Being also hopelessly in love with Johnny's older sister, Sarah, Jacoby had at once told the family he would do anything they wanted to help them get even for Johnny's untimely death. He'd hoped this would endear him to Sarah, but she hadn't seemed to notice him when he made the offer just after her brother's funeral. She'd been quiet, kind of off in her own world, as if she was thinking of something else. Old Angus McDougal, eaten up with grief and the need for vengeance, had questioned Sheriff Wally Tupper about where Jensen and his friends had been heading after they'd killed his son. Sheriff Tupper had said that one of the men, William Cornelius Van Horn, was a famous Canadian railroad builder. Angus had done some checking, and afterward he'd sent Carl up to Canada to follow Jensen and his men and to let the old man know when they headed back to the States so he could avenge his son's death. He told Jacoby to stay out of Jensen's way, not to brace him or to let him know he was being watched. Just keep an eye on him and make sure they didn't leave Canada without Jacoby knowing about it. Jacoby had done so gladly, sure that no one could have bested Johnny in a fair fight, him being the quickest man with a shotgun Carl had ever seen. That is, until the gunfight he'd just now witnessed. He shook his head, remembering how many times he'd been tempted over the past 6 months to just step up to Jensen and draw his gun and shoot the bastard down. His stomach grew queasy at the thought of what would have happened had he been so foolish. Hell, he'd be lying dead and buried in the forsaken wilderness above the border, that's what. Jacoby turned his head from the sight of the men from the train, picking up the dead outlaws' bodies and stacking them in an empty boxcar, and he thought about what he was going to do next. He knew that if he continued on his mission for Angus McDougal, Sooner or later, he would have to go up against Jensen and his friends, and that thought scared him half to death. On the other hand, if he quit now and headed back to Pueblo with his tail between his legs, he was sure Sarah McDougal would never give him another look, at least not the kind of look he'd want her to give him. She'd more than likely think him a coward and a fool, and would never again give him the time of day. Jacoby looked up as the conductor came down the aisle, telling all the passengers that they would be on their way shortly and that all of their money and valuables would be returned to them at the next stop, thanks to Smoke Jensen and his friends.
Sir?
Yes, sir?
Will there be a telegraph at the next stop?
Why, yes, I believe there is, sir.
Thanks.
Carl turned his mind to just what he was going to say to Angus. He knew he'd better warn him about Jensen's ability with a gun, but he didn't want to come off sounding like he was afraid of the man, even though the plain truth of the matter was that he was more frightened of Jensen than of anything else he could imagine. Carl scrunched down in his seat and pulled his hat down over his eyes. This was going to take some heavy thinking before they got to the next stop if he was going to get it right. After all, he remembered, Angus McDougal didn't exactly take kindly to being told he was wrong about anything, and especially not about this. Angus McDougal sat on his porch smoking a corn cob pipe, still wearing his black mourning suit, even though it had been more than 6 months since his only son had been shot down on the streets of Pueblo, Colorado. He nodded slowly to himself when he recognized the portly figure of Sheriff Wally Tupper riding toward him. He felt like he'd aged 10 years since Johnny died, but then the death of a loved one will tend to do that to a person, he figured. He walked down the porch and waved a greeting to the sheriff. Tupper climbed down out of the saddle and held up an envelope in his hand as he climbed the steps to the porch.
I got this here wire for you from Carl Jacoby, Angus. It came in on the telegraph just this morning, and I rode right out here to bring it to you first thing.
What's it say?
Well, I don't know. I wouldn't presume to read a wire addressed to you, Angus. You know that.
I know you'd better not, Wally. Now go on into the kitchen and have the cook fix you some coffee while I read this, and then we'll talk.
Angus slit the envelope with a thumbnail and pulled out the folded sheet of paper. It was indeed a telegram from Carl Jacoby. Angus squinted his eyes. It looked to be from some pissant town in Minnesota that he'd never heard of before. Angus reached into the breast pocket of his coat and pulled out a pair of reading spectacles he'd taken to using in the last year when he found he was unable to read the local newspaper without holding it way out at arm's length. The telegram read,
"Have seen Jensen and his men in action. Stop. Very impressive. Stop. Do not think they would have to back shoot anyone. Stop. Please check situation again before proceeding. Stop. Should arrive Big Rock 7 to 10 days, depending on weather. And Carl."
Angus crumpled up the paper and gritted his teeth so hard his jaw creaked. He whirled around and stomped across the porch and into his house. He found Sheriff Tupper drinking coffee out of a mug and flirting with his Mexican housekeeper, Lupe. Lupe poured Angus a cup of coffee and put it on the table in front of him.
"Would you excuse us, Lupe? Man talk."
She nodded and quickly vanished from the dining room. Tupper raised his eyebrows when he saw the crumpled sheet of paper in Angus's hand.
"Bad news?"
"Tell me again about the day my boy Johnny was shot down, Wally."
"Oh, are you sure you want to hear all that again?"
"I asked, didn't I?"
"Well, from what I heard from those who were there, Johnny and the boys had been drinking a mite, and they proceeded to tease Jensen and the men with him about how they smelled. Shortly, one of those old mountain men riding with Jensen jumped up and knocked Johnny to the floor."
"And Johnny hadn't drawn on the man up till then?"
"Nope. Matter of fact, Johnny was flat on his back after the man attacked him without no warning."
"What happened then?"
"Well, sir, Johnny's friends took him outside, and they waited for Jensen and his men to come out of the feed bag and into the street.
And when they did?
This is where the stories all get a mite different. Johnny and his friends all had their guns in their hands when I got there, but only Johnny's had been fired, and he'd only gotten off the one shot. But the man with Jensen, William Cornelius Van Horn, said Johnny and his men had fired at them first and started the fracas.
And you believed him, even though none of the boys managed to get a shot off?
I didn't have no choice, Angus. This Van Horn man carries a lot of weight in the state, and he knows the governor personally.
And tell me again, just how many times was my boy shot?
Well, the Undertaker said he had over 6 slugs in him, Angus.
And you honestly think, knowing how fast Johnny was with a 6 gun, that he could be standing there with his guns out and only get off one shot whilst someone else has to take the time to draw and ends up shooting him 6 times? No, sir. There ain't nobody alive that fast.
Well, what do you think happened then?
I think those bastards shot my boy and his friends down in cold blood. And then they took out their guns and put them in their hands so it'd look like a fair fight.
Before Sheriff Tupper could answer, saying there'd been plenty of other witnesses to dispute Angus's version of the gunplay, the door opened and a pretty young woman in her mid-20s walked into the room, her face a mask of anguish. It was obvious she'd been listening to Tupper and Angus from the other room.
That's not all they did to him, Daddy.
What do you mean by that, Sarah?
Sarah, you really think this is necessary?
Yes, Wally, I do. My father deserves to know the truth about what was done to his son and my little brother.
Damn it, don't talk about me like I wasn't even in the room. Wally, if you know more than you've been telling me for the past 6 months, you better spit it out now, or I'll make you wish the hell you had.
Well, Angus, when I got to Johnny's body, I saw a deep cut on his cheek and saw that his 2 front teeth had been knocked out.
What?
Well, now, hold on, Angus. I asked around, and it seems Johnny was ragging the men with Jensen about them being smelly and dirty, and one of the old mountain men took offense at it and pulled out his Colt and pistol-whipped Johnny with it. I didn't say nothing about it, because it was plain to see that Johnny had picked the fight in the first place.
Now I see why Johnny was waiting outside for those men to leave the saloon. His pride was hurt because of the beating he took in front of his friends.
Sarah stepped over and laid her hand gently on Angus's shoulder.
That doesn't alter the fact that Johnny was shot down in cold blood, Daddy. And that was after they slashed his face and knocked his teeth out.
You're right, Sarah. Even though Johnny was spoiled and a hothead who never knew when to shut his mouth, he didn't deserve to be shot down on the street like a stray dog for it. Him and his friends both.
Now, Angus, don't go off half-cocked. Johnny's dead, and there ain't nothing you can do gonna change that. Killing Jensen and his men won't change anything, Angus.
No, I can't change it, Wally. But I can sure as hell make sure someone pays for what they did to my boy.
Sarah blinked back tears and turned and walked slowly from the room and out the door to stand on the front porch, staring at the mountain peaks in the distance. She'd always hated Johnny, ever since they were little kids. Up until she was 5 years old, she'd been the apple of her daddy's eye, and he'd taken her everywhere with him, teaching her to ride and shoot like a man. Then Johnny had been born, and her life had changed forever. All of a sudden, it was as if she ceased to exist, and her daddy's world revolved around his new son. It hadn't been fair. From the beginning, she could ride and shoot better than Johnny, and she was smarter in the bargain. But that didn't matter to Angus McDougal. All he cared about was having a son to carry on his name. Well, that was over now, Sarah thought bitterly. His precious son's big mouth had finally gotten him into some trouble their daddy couldn't buy his way out of. Sarah shook her head and entered the house again. She walked into her room and began to pack her bags. She planned to be in Big Rock when Smoke Jensen and his friends arrived. She had it all worked out in her mind. She'd move into town using a fake name, get a job, and no one would know she'd come there to put Smoke Jensen in his grave. As she flung her clothes into the valise, She thought that maybe Angus would again give her the respect and attention she deserved. Sheriff Monte Carson was waiting at the station in Big Rock when Smoke Jensen and his friends Cal Pearly and Lewis Longmont got off the train. The four men were tired and their faces were drawn. This was from the long train ride from up near the Canadian border, and it looked as if they'd all lost weight on their journey to Canada and back. Monte walked over and slapped Smoke on the shoulder, smiling at the men standing next to him.
Well, boys, I bet it's good to get home, ain't it?
It is certainly good to get my posterior off of those torture devices the railroad calls seats. I do believe they stuff those seats with rocks.
Just think how bad it would have been if we had to sit in regular seats instead of those padded ones in Mr. Hill's car.
I'd rather not think about that eventuality, if you don't mind.
Monty's deputy tipped his hat and said hi to the men before he walked off down the platform toward the baggage and livestock cars.
Jim's gonna get your hosses and luggage and all. Why don't we head on over to Lewis's place and get some good grub into you boys? Y'all look like you've been starved half to death up there in the North Country.
Did I hear somebody say grub?
That sounds awfully good, Monty. I could use some coffee that I don't have to chew before swallowing. After riding with mountain men for a spell, any coffee that won't float a horseshoe is considered too weak to bother with.
Yeah, like they said, their coffee don't take near as much water as you think it do.
Daniel Macklin sat on a bench at the far end of the platform, whittling on a stick and watching the men as they moved off toward the downtown area. He'd been on this same bench watching the arrival of each and every train that pulled into Big Rock for the past 3 months. His lips curled into a slow grin as he realized his job was just about over. The fingers of Macklin's right hand twitched as they hung just above the butt of his pistol, tied down low on his right thigh. He forced the hand to relax, deciding to wait until he'd contacted Angus McDougal before he braced Jensen. He hoped that when Angus found out Jensen was back in town, he would wire him back, giving him permission to kill the son of a bitch. That would be fitting, he thought, since the man Jensen had killed had been some of his best friends. He got slowly to his feet, dropped the sharpened stick to the ground as he leaned his shoulder against the corner of the building, and waited for Carl Jacoby to get off the train. Angus had wired him Jacoby was trailing Jensen, so Macklin figured he'd be somewhere on the same train. Sure enough, a few minutes after Jensen and his friends had left, Macklin saw Jacoby exit a car further down the track. As Jacoby put his bag down and looked around, Macklin grinned. Jacoby was also a good friend of his, though Macklin thought he was a dumbass for mooning over Sarah McDougal like a hound dog in heat. Sarah would never give ordinary cowhands like them the time of day. She'd been groomed since she was just a pup for finer things, men more important than country boys. Of course, that was before her brother had been killed. Who knows what was going on in her mind at this stage? Jacoby nodded, picked up his bag, and walked toward Macklin.
Hey, Mac. How you doing?
Macklin looked down at the large pile of wood shavings from his Whitman, and he grinned.
I'm doing a mite better now that you and Jensen are here. I'm sick of cooling my heels for the past few months, waiting on y'all to get back from the North Country.
I hear that. Now, come on, show me to the nearest saloon. My mouth's so dry I'm spitting cotton.
Don't you think we better wire old Angus first and tell him everybody's here?
Nah, I wired him from along the way telling him when we were gonna get here. Besides, there's some things I gotta tell you before we decide on just how to proceed with this matter. Important things.
At Longmont Saloon, the men all took seats at Lewis's regular table just as the young black man who was the head waiter appeared, carrying a tray with a silver coffee service and 5 mugs on it. As they drank their coffee, Monty leaned back.
All right now, boys. Tell me all about your adventures up there north of the border.
First, Monty, I want to know if you've heard from Sally.
Oh, dagnabbit, I almost forgot. I got a wire yesterday. It said she'd gotten your telegram saying you were on your way home. She said her father's doing much better and she'll probably be here in the next week or so.
Smoke didn't answer, but the smile on his face showed how pleased he was with the news. Before he'd left for Canada a few months back, his wife Sally had gone back east to be with her ailing father. Smoke was glad to hear the man was better and that she'd be home soon, for he missed her terribly. Pearly stuck a cigarette he'd built into his mouth, leaned back as he got it going, and proceeded to give a slightly exaggerated account of the men's adventures in the Canadian wilds over the past 6 months. He ended his narrative with the tale of the train robbers.
And Cal here actually got into a gunfight with us without getting wounded, if you can believe that.
Cal unconsciously reached under the table and rubbed the sore spot on his thigh, where he had in fact been slightly wounded, something he'd managed to keep from his friends. It wasn't his fault that bullets just naturally seemed to seek him out, no matter how careful he was in the gunfights. Luckily, though he was a frequent target, none of the wounds had been overly serious.
Well, now that is something. Maybe your luck's changing, Cal.
Just then, Andre appeared, followed by two waiters with platters of heaping food in their hands.
All right!
Macklin took Jacoby by his hotel, arranged for him to get a room there, and dropped off his luggage, and then showed him into a restaurant that served both liquor and food. While they drank a glass of whiskey and waited for their food orders to arrive, Jacoby told Macklin about the gunfight on the train between Jensen and his friends and the outlaws who'd outnumbered them. Jacoby shook his head and drained his glass, sleeving whiskey off his lips with his arm.
It was the damnedest thing I've ever seen, Mac. One minute Jensen and his friends are standing there in front of maybe 10 outlaws, and before you could spit, they hands full of iron and they were blasting the crap out of those hombres.
Just because a man's an outlaw don't necessarily mean he's fast on the draw, Carl.
Oh, that's just it, Mac. All them bandits already had their guns in their hands when Jensen and his men drew down on them.
And you're saying none of those outlaws managed to draw any blood?
That's just what I'm saying, Mac. Jensen and his men walked away from that fracas as clean as a whistle. And what was even more funny is they didn't even wait for the bandits to make a play at them or to try to take the money. They went looking for outlaws, as if they kinda enjoyed the thought of a good fight.
Just what are you saying, Carl? You saying Jensen is faster on the draw than Johnny McDougal was?
Hey, Mac, I'm telling you the truth. I know Johnny was fast with a six killer, because I drawed against him in contests before, but Jensen is faster by a long shot.
So you think it may have been a fair fight when Johnson shot Johnny down in Pueblo?
Hell, I weren't there, Mac, so I can't say for certain. All I know is Jensen could snatch a quarter off a rattler's head and leave two dimes and a nickel for change for the snake could strike. And by the way, Mac, I've seen you draw before, too. So if you're planning on going up against Jensen, you better plan on shooting him in the back from a long way off, or I'll be taking your dead body back to Pueblo with me when I leave this burg.
Macklin's face flushed and he gritted his teeth for a sharp retort, but was interrupted by the waiter reappearing with a platter containing their food orders. When the waiter left, Jacoby, who noticed the angry expression on Macklin's face when he warned him not to try and outdraw Jensen, wisely decided to change the subject before Macklin got really pissed off.
You've been here long enough to ask around. What is Jensen's reputation in this town?
Hell, around here they think he's better than a homemade apple pie. I couldn't find a single person in this town had a bad word to say about Jensen or the men riding with him. Hell, seems Jensen founded this town some years ago, so naturally, nobody's gonna say nothing against him.
Well, that's what I figured you'd say. From what I've seen on the train, Jensen's pretty much a square shooter.
So what? Angus McDougal didn't send us here to check out his character. He sent us here to let him know when he got home and possibly to put a bullet in him and his friends.
Oh, but Mac, what if his fight with Johnny was fair and it was like they said and Johnny fired off the shots at them first? Hell, we all know what an asshole Johnny could be when he was all liquored up.
Don't make no never mind to me what happened back in Pueblo. All I know is Johnny and the others that died with him were friends of mine, and I aim to see Jensen in his grave for what he done to them, and I aim to do it with or without you, Carl. So don't be getting in my way or you're liable to catch some lead, too.
Don't go playing the big man with me, Mac. Remember, I saw you draw before, and I ain't all that certain you could take me, even if you was crazy enough to try.
Well then, how about I put it like this? Old man McDougal been pretty good to both of us, it seems. So if and he wants Jensen dead for whatever reason, it's plenty good enough for me. And what do you think Sarah's gonna say when she hears you gone all soft and sweet on Jensen, the man that killed her baby brother?
Maybe if I can explain to her...
Explain what? That the man who put 6 slugs in her little brother after bashing out his front teeth is really just a nice feller, and we should just forget about the whole thing.
You're right, Mac. She'll never understand. She's like her father. She don't forget a slight, and she sure as hell won't care what I think about Jensen's character, that's for sure.
Yeah, if you're finished with that steak, maybe we better get on over to the telegraph office and wire Angus to see what he wants us to do.
Sally Jensen eased out of her seat on the train when it pulled into the station at Pueblo, Colorado. The next stop would be Big Rock, and she wanted to freshen up a little before arriving home. She hadn't seen Smoke for more than half a year, and she wanted to look her best when he met her at the station. She could already imagine him throwing his arms around her and squeezing her tight against his hard body. When she looked into the mirror in the women's parlor compartment as she applied a light dusting of powder and just a hint of lip rouge, she noticed that the thought of seeing her man again after so long was making her cheeks flush and burn as if they were on fire.
Why, Sally Jensen, you're acting like a hussy instead of an old married woman.
Pardon me?
A young woman who was just entering the compartment raised her eyebrows at the sight of Sally talking to herself in the mirror.
Oh, don't mind me, miss. I'm just returning home after a long absence, and the excitement of seeing my husband and home again after so long has me behaving a bit silly.
The young woman stepped in front of another mirror across the room and spent a few moments adjusting her hat and dress. Sally thought the girl probably wasn't used to wearing such nice clothes, the way she picked at the buttons and continually fussed with the ruffled collar on the neckline. And she certainly didn't know how to wear a frilly hat. She had it at completely the wrong angle.
Here, let me help you with that.
Sally moved over to smooth out the ruffles in the back of the dress and make it a bit more comfortable for the young woman, and to adjust the tilt of the hat to a more rakish angle.
Thank you. I'm Sarah, Sarah Johnson.
Hello, Sarah. I'm Sally Jensen. Are you traveling far, Sarah?
Just Big Rock, Mrs. Jensen.
Oh, just call me Sally, Sarah. We're not very formal in Big Rock, as you'll find out when we get there.
All right. Sally.
Why don't you sit with me, dear, and you can tell me all about your trip to Big Rock.
After Sarah had stashed her valise on the overhead rack, she sat down next to Sally and they began to talk.
Are you visiting friends or family in Big Rock?
Not really, Sally. I just had to get out of Pueblo and Big Rock seemed like a nice place to move to.
I hope I'm not being too nosy, Sarah, but just why do you have to get out of Pueblo?
When Sarah hesitated and stared past Sally out the window, Sally patted her on the arm.
Oh, never mind, dear. Your reasons are none of my business, and I fear I'm intruding on your privacy.
Oh, don't worry, Sally. It's nothing all that mysterious. It's just that I was engaged until recently to a prominent member of Pueblo society. When we decided to cancel our engagement, people began to talk, and my family thought it best if I moved away for at least a little while to let matters settle down.
An affair of the heart often makes tongues waggle, especially tongues of the gossip mongers who like nothing better than to besmirch someone else's reputation. Now, even though the people of Big Rock are very nice, Sarah, I wouldn't be too quick to tell anyone your story. It is, after all, a small town, and it does have gossips just like all towns do.
That's it exactly, Sally. Oh, I knew you'd understand.
Of course I understand, dear. I'm not so old that I cannot remember what it was like when my husband first began courting me, and how the gossip flew hot and heavy all around my town at the time.
Tell me about your husband, Sally. What's his name?
Well, his name is Kirby, Sarah, but he goes by Smoke, or at least that's what everyone, including me, calls him.
Smoke? Why? What an unusual name.
Sally's eyes became distant as she thought back to what Smoke had told her of his early days in the Wild West. Sarah stared at Sally, who seemed lost in a pleasant memory for the moment. This wasn't what she'd expected. Most gunmen, at least all that she'd been acquainted with or told about, didn't have wives. They were, for the most part, a sorry lot of drunkards and malcontents who drifted from one place to another, selling their guns and their willingness to kill without reason to the highest bidder. And the women they took up with when they weren't busy killing were nothing like Sally Jensen.
Mrs. Jensen?
Excuse me, Sarah. I fear my long journey has tired me considerably, and I was daydreaming for a moment.
No, that's all right. You seem to be someplace else for a minute. Someplace nice.
I was just remembering some tales my husband told me of his first days out here in the wilderness, back when he was no more than a child.
Oh?
Yes. Things were very different then, and Smoke had to learn to use both his wits and his guns at a very young age. Thank goodness we're much more civilized nowadays, and things are different.
Sarah decided it would be best if she could find out all she could about this man she was planning to kill. This man who went by the unlikely name Smoke. She didn't like taking advantage of a nice woman like Sally, but it wasn't her fault the lady had married a monster and didn't seem to realize it. Perhaps if she could get her to talk about him, she'd find out how best to get close to him and then take him out.
Please, Sally, if you're not too tired, tell me some of those tales about your husband's early days out here and how he got such an unusual name as Smoke.
Well, I wouldn't want to bore you.
Oh, you won't. My father used to tell my brother and me how he'd got started years ago, back when things were very different in Colorado Territory, and his stories always fascinated us.
We're a lot alike, Sarah. I, too, have always been interested in the history of the Old West.
Sally settled back in her seat and closed her eyes, letting the memories of the stories Smoke had told her come to the front of her mind.
Smoke was 16 years old when his father returned to their hard scrabble farm in Missouri from fighting for the Gray in the Civil War. When young Kirby told his father that his mother, Emmett's wife, had died the previous spring, Emmett put the farm up for sale, and he and Kirby moved off, headed west. They rode westward, edging north for several weeks, moving towards country controlled by the Kiowa and Pawnee Indians. When they arrived at the Santa Fe Trail, they met up with a mountain man who called himself Preacher. He was dressed entirely in buckskins, from his moccasins to his wide-brimmed hat. Young Kirby thought him the dirtiest man he'd ever seen. Even his white beard was so stained with tobacco as to be almost black. Soon after their meeting, the three men were ambushed by a group of Indians that Preacher said were Pawnees, and took refuge in a buffalo wallow just behind a low ridge. Suddenly, the meadow all around was filled with screaming, charging Indians.
Don't look at me, boy. Keep them eyes in front of you.
Kirby jerked his gaze to the small creek and the stand of timber that lay behind him. His eyes were beginning to smart from the acrid powder smoke. His head was aching, pounding with a Henry 44, screaming and yelling. The Spencer that Kirby held at the ready was a heavy weapon, and his arms were beginning to ache from the strain. His head suddenly came up, eyes alert. He'd seen movement on the far side of the creek. Someone or something was over there. Kirby couldn't understand why they couldn't be friends with these people. And that thought was still throbbing in his brain when a young Injun suddenly sprang from the willows by the creek and lunged into the water with a rifle in his hand. For what seemed like an eternity, Kirby watched the young brave, a boy about his own age, leap and thrash through the water. Kirby jacked back the hammer and the Spencer and sighted in on the brave. When the smoke blew away, the young Injun was face down in the water, his blood staining the stream. Kirby stared at what he'd done, then fought back waves of sickness that threatened to spill from his stomach. Suddenly, his father was locked in hand-to-hand combat with two knife-wielding braves. Too close for the rifle, Kirby clawed his Navy Colt from leather, vowing he would cut that stupid flap from his holster after this was over. Kirby took out one brave. Kirby's father buried his Arkansas toothpick to the hilt in the chest of the other. Then, as abruptly as they came, the engines were gone, dragging as many of their dead and wounded with them as they could. Two braves lay dead in front of Preacher. Two braves lay dead in the shallow ravine with the three men. The boy Kirby had shot lay in the creek, arms outstretched, the water a deep crimson. The body slowly floated downstream. Preacher looked at the dead buck in the creek, then at the brave in the wallow with him, the one Kirby had shot. He lifted his eyes to the boy.
You got your baptism this day, boy. Did right well, you did.
Saved my life, son. Can't call you boy no more, I reckon. You be a man now.
A thin finger of smoke lifted from the barrel of the Navy 36 that Kirby held in his hand. Preacher smiled.
Yep. Smoke will suit you just fine. So smoke it'll be.
Sir?
Smoke. That's what I'm going to call you from now on. Smoke.
Sarah's face was flushed, and she was fanning herself with a small handkerchief as Sally finished her tale of how her husband came to be called Smoke and of his introduction to the Wild West. The story had been very exciting, and somehow it reminded Sarah of the stories Cletus and her father had told her as she was growing up about how they'd had to hold off Indian attacks and bandit attacks while still trying to raise crops and cattle and babies.
My, my, Sally. That was quite a story.
Things were quite different in those days, Sarah. The Indians were still around and hated the intrusion of the white man. And there was no law to call upon when you got into trouble. People had to learn to take matters into their own hands. And they became very tough in the doing.
And did this country make your husband tough, Sally?
Sally pursed her lips as she thought about the question. She didn't quite know how to answer it. True, Smoke was as tough a man when provoked as she'd ever met. And when he was with her, he was invariably gentle and kind, and she knew that there was no man more loyal to his friends than her husband, or more fearsome to his enemies. So she guessed Smoke was tough when he needed to be, and gentle and kind when he was allowed to be. Unable to put all this into words without sounding like a fool, though, she just shrugged.
I suppose Smoke became as tough as he needed to be to survive in those days. But thankfully, those days are gone now, and he has little need for that ability nowadays. Nowadays, he spends his time with me on our ranch just outside Big Rock, raising cattle and horses and being a boring old homebody. And speaking of Big Rock, I do believe we're pulling into town right now.
Sarah followed Sally's gaze, hoping her friends already stationed there wouldn't be foolish enough to try to meet her at the station. She told Sally she didn't know anyone in town and she didn't want them to make a liar out of her. She realized if she was going to have any chance to get close to Smoke Jensen to do him in, she was going to have the trust of his wife.
Oh, well, here I go, about to start a new life for myself. I hope I'll be able to find a nice place to stay and a good job soon.
I'm sure that won't be a problem. I know that Ed and Peg Jackson, who own the town's largest general store, are always looking for someone to help out so that Peg can spend more time at home with the children. And there's a very nice boarding house right on Main Street that caters to young single women.
Oh, thank you, Sally. I don't know what I'd done if we hadn't met.
Of course, if money is tight, you could always stay at our ranch for a while until you've worked long enough to afford your own place.
Oh, that is so kind of you, Sally, but my father made sure I had plenty of money when he sent me here. I have enough to tide me over until I get a few paydays behind me, but I would appreciate the chance to see your spread and visit with you if I get too lonely.
Well, you know that you're always welcome, Sarah, and I'll be sure to have you out to dinner once you're settled in.
Two women moved down the aisle when the train had ground to a halt.
I'll stop by the Jackson's place on my way out of town and tell them that you'll be calling for a job.
Sarah nodded, Her mind elsewhere, she searched the small crowd on the platform, looking for either Carl Jacoby or Dan Macklin. If she saw them, she was going to have to give them some sign to stay away until they could meet later, when no one was around to see them. Fortunately, there were no familiar faces in the crowd waiting on the platform, and Sarah let herself relax. Still, it wouldn't hurt to be extra careful. Sarah decided to take her time exiting from the train so she wouldn't be next to Sally, just in case her friends were out there and waiting for her. She went back into the ladies' parlor room and pretended to be fussing with her hat and dress in front of the mirror, giving Sally plenty of time to leave the place ahead of her. Sally, too, was anxiously scanning the crowd, looking for her husband as she stood on the platform, her heart beating a little faster than usual in her anticipation of seeing and holding him again. Just as she was about to give up, thinking that perhaps he hadn't gotten her wire stating her arrival day, she saw him on the edge of town, leaning up against the wall of the station house. She was glad to note the way his eyes lit up and his lips curled in a wide grin when he spied her. She dropped her valise and ran into his arms, inhaling the musky man scent of him. She was where she belonged, finally, and it had been a long time since she'd felt so safe and happy. She wondered briefly if he could feel the way her heart beat wildly in her chest at the touch of his arms around her. She leaned back and looked up at his hair. Usually unruly, with a lock or two falling down over his forehead in a most appealing manner, it was shiny and slicked back and smelled faintly of pomade.
I see you've changed your hair.
Oh, I thought I'd get a trim in honor of your arrival. So I let the barber whack a little bit off the sides. He put that smelly stuff in it before I could stop him, and I didn't have time to wash it out before your train was due to arrive.
Well, don't worry. I'll heat us up some water when we get to the Sugarloaf, and we'll have a bath.
We?
Of course. I have to wash the grime of my journey off, and you have to get that pomade out of your hair. If we share the bath, you won't have to work so hard to bring extra water into the cabin.
So, I see that you've missed me as much as I've missed you.
More.
Sally looked around at the crowd of people near the baggage car, hoping to see Sarah. She wanted to introduce Smoke to her new friend, but Sarah was nowhere to be seen. She made a mental note to tell Smoke to be sure and stop by the general store on their way out of town so she could tell Peg Jackson about the girl who wanted to work there. Peg would be ecstatic since that would allow her more time at home with their children. At that very moment, standing only a couple of dozen feet behind Smoke and Sally, Sarah put her hand in her handbag and closed her fingers around the butt of a snub-nosed Smith & Wesson 36 revolver. Her eyes narrowed as she saw for the first time the man who'd killed her brother. Her heart beat fast and she began to tremble at the sight of the monster who'd ruined her family. Perhaps it would be best to get this over with and kill him now. After all, she might never get a better chance. She started to pull the weapon out and put a bullet in the back of his head, but a hand closed over her arm. She whirled about, her hate-filled eyes glaring at Carl Jacoby.
Not here and not now, Sarah. Don't be a fool.
You're right, Carl. Shot in the back with no warning would be too easy for that man. I want to look into his eyes when he knows he's about to die and tell him just why I'm going to kill him. I want him to suffer. To think about never seeing his wife again, to know what his dastardly act in Pueblo cost him.
Carl glanced around to make sure no one was watching. Sarah was really worked up, with a red face and animated talk. He knew he'd better get her out of sight before someone came up and asked what was going on.
Come on, Sarah. I got a room reserved for you at the hotel.
She stopped him with a hand on his chest. Nice girls didn't stay at hotels, especially by themselves, without any other family around.
Carl. I think I'll get a room at the boarding house Mrs. Jensen recommended to me.
What do you mean, Mrs. Jensen?
I'll explain it all to you later, over dinner. This place does have an acceptable eating establishment, I take it?
He nodded, his expression worried. He still couldn't believe she'd been talking to Smoke Jensen's wife on the train. He'd hoped she hadn't given anything away. He knew that if the people of this town thought that anyone was going to try and harm their favorite son, Smoke Jensen, they'd most likely string him up from the nearest maple tree. Cal and Pearlie were lying around the bunkhouse, mending socks and sewing buttons on shirts and doing all the things that needed doing after a few months away from home. They heard the buckboard pull up in front of the ranch house.
Hey, Pearlie, it's Smoke and Sally.
Oh, hold on, Pard. Just where do you think you're going?
Didn't you hear me, Pearlie? Miss Sally's back from her trip. I'm gonna go out there and tell her hello.
No, you're not, youngin'.
And just why not? It's been almost a year since I seen her, and I want to tell her how much I missed her.
Son, I know you ain't had a whole passel of experience with women folk like I have, so I guess I'll just have to excuse your ignorance on the subject and maybe try and explain a few things to you.
And what does my experience with females have to do with anything except your dirty mind?
Think about it, Cal. Smoke and Sally have been away from each other for the better part of a year now, and they're fixing to be alone together for the first time in a lot of months.
So? That's what I've been saying. Miss Sally's been gone a long time and...
Do I have to spell it out for you, Cal? Who do you think Sally wants to spend time with right now? You or Smoke?
Suddenly it dawned on Cal what Pearlie was trying to hint at.
But you don't think they're gonna... Oh.
Well, if an I was Smoke and I hadn't been with my wife in over 6 or 7 months, I sure as hell would first chance I got.
But it's daylight outside.
Boy, do you have a lot to learn, Kyle. More than you can ever imagine.
A couple of hours later, after Sally had heated enough water to fill the oversized tub they kept in their spare bedroom, and after they'd both managed to get freshened up from their trip and their rather exuberant welcome home, Smoke knocked on the bunkhouse door. Smoke leaned inside. There was no one there except Cal and Pearlie, the other hands not in from the fields yet.
You boys interested in some real home cooking for a change?
You don't mean you're gonna make Miss Sally cook her first night back home, do you, boss?
I offered to eat leftovers from Cookie's dinner meal, but she insisted on cooking. Said it'd been a long time since she cooked for her family, and she wanted to do it.
You sure she intended for you to ask Pearlie and me over too, Smoke?
Well, Sally said she wanted to cook for her family. Who the heck do you think she meant?
You bet, Smoke. Give us a few minutes to clean up, and we'll be right over.
Well, don't take too long. If my nose isn't wrong, I think her fresh apple pie is just about ready.
Pearlie's eyes opened wide and he whirled around and headed for the pitcher and wash basin in the corner, already rolling his sleeves up. He hadn't had any of Sally's wonderful home cooking for a long time and he could hardly wait.
Of course, you're going to have to wait until you finish the fried chicken and mashed potatoes and green beans and fresh baked rolls before she's going to let you have any of that pie.
Fried chicken?
And mashed potatoes and fresh green beans and oven-baked bread. Out of the way, Cal, lest you want to get runned over.